This is AM with Sabra Lane.
Has the government done enough to bring down the price of gas? I'll ask the Treasurer, Scott Morrison. As the Australian Federal Police celebrates 100 years, Commissioner Andrew Colvin tells me about his biggest challenge. And how does the Australian music industry respond to claims of harassment?
The guys were like, oh yeah, that happens to all of our female colleagues. And then they just like turned their backs on me and started drinking. I guess my expectations were I would tell this band who was older, more knowledgeable, wiser, and in a position of power to do something. And they kind of just dismissed it as normal.
Good morning and welcome to AM. Australia's domestic gas supply is increasing, but prices are still too high. That's the latest message in a new report from the competition watchdog, the ACCC. It comes after the federal government pressured the big gas companies to boost local reserves. From Canberra, Lucy Barber reports.
Gas prices have been going through the roof in recent years.
Double, triple, quadruple for some businesses and some consumers. And it's meant that some companies just could not get gas.
Australia has plenty of gas to go around, but the boom in LNG exports from Queensland has seen the vast majority sold overseas. That's pushed domestic gas supply down and prices up. And it's why the head of the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, Rod Sims, has been warning of a gas shortfall early next year.
It's been a catastrophic effect on the Australian economy.
He was pleased in September when the federal government struck a deal with the big gas companies to boost local supply. The Prime Minister threatened to impose export restrictions on Shell, Origin and Santos if they didn't cooperate. Rod Sims' latest gas inquiry report predicts that as a result, there'll now be a surplus next year instead.
We've gone from a projected shortfall of about 50 petajoules to a net positive of 20 petajoules. The LNG producers did provide an extra 42 petajoules to the domestic market and cut back exports, and that's contributed to that turnaround.
Rod Sims says that's made gas cheaper to buy.
For many companies fall from around $16 to around $8 to $12.
Industry groups have welcomed the report, but say they're cautiously optimistic.
Rather than getting absolutely hammered on their next contract, they will instead be pained or at best peeved.
Tennant Reid from the Australian Industry Group says gas prices have dropped significantly, but overall energy bills are still a big problem.
Almost halved from where prices were, but it's still twice to three times as high as the prices that the market averaged over the past few decades. So it's still, by historic standards, pretty bad.
Rod Sims isn't getting too excited either.
Look, we're in a pretty bad position. The market's still tight and we think prices are still higher than they should be.
He says Australia still needs more gas and he wants New South Wales and Victoria to help provide it by lifting any existing bans on gas exploration.
So that where there are environmental problems, we don't allow gas, but where there aren't problems, we do, so we get more supply in the market. I'm afraid that's the only thing that's going to help. And it will also help the electricity market because it will lower electricity prices as well.
The chairman of the ACCC, Rod Sims, ending Lucy Barber's report. Joining us now is the Federal Treasurer, Scott Morrison. Good morning and welcome to the program.
G'day, Sabra. And Merry Christmas. Yeah.
Thank you, you too. The ACCC has found that some short-term improvements in the gas market, but it still says it's not operating effectively and that prices are still too high. What guarantees can you offer to industrial users that you will deliver cheaper, reasonable prices in 2019?
Well, we've already demonstrated that by what we've already achieved. What we said when we got together with the big gas companies earlier this year, with the Prime Minister and Barnaby Joyce and Josh Frydenberg, we had a shortfall of gas for the next year and the year after, and we've been able to turn that round into a surplus on the estimated demand. We've seen not only those prices fall from, as Rod just said, from about $16 per gigajoule down to 8 to 12, but we've also seen these large commercial industrial users getting more offers as well, which they weren't getting. I mean, I'll give you an example. Up in Townsville, we had a refinery up there which wasn't going to have its gas contract extended beyond the 31st of December this year. And as a result of our interventions there, we've been able to ensure that that didn't happen and they got their gas. I'd like them to get it at an even better price than they've got it. But at the same time, the Commonwealth has acted. And the issue now is still an issue of supply, particularly in the southern states. And I think that's what the ACCC is highlighting. The gas that we need is under people's feet in New South Wales and in Victoria.
We'll get to that in a moment, but if demand for gas next year reaches the top end of demand forecasts, given the graph on page 11 of that ACCC report, Australia could still be short 33 petajoules next year.
Well, I'm very confident in the conversations we've had with the gas providers that should that more extreme situation come about, that will also be met. And that was the nature of the conversations we had. I mean, in terms of what's being contracted now, that has been lifted. There are more offers out there in the marketplace. And there is a flexibility that has now been built in by this process, which will ensure that I think we have the flexibility to respond to higher demand scenarios. So, I mean, we said we'd take action. We did take action. In the space of literally months, we've seen the price fall from $16 down to as low as $8. And for smaller CNI users, they've also seen a big change as well.
They have, but not by the same amount.
Well, actually, the fall that they've had has also been significant, from around 18 down to 11, 18, 19. So they were facing even higher prices. So there's no doubt that the ACCC report shows that the Prime Minister's action to engage the gas companies has worked. Now, there is further work that has to be done, but that largely rests with getting the gas out from under people's feet. Now, that is not something that is in the control of the Commonwealth government. That's obviously in the domain of state governments. And as Rod shows in his report, people in the southern states, particularly in Victoria, are paying $2 at least more because of the transport costs, and we still have a shortage in the southern states on what is available in the southern states. It has to be taken down from Queensland.
But even as you point out, the Commonwealth can't do anything in this territory, given those states and territories so far have ignored your demands to lift moratoriums. You're powerless, aren't you, to do anything to lift those bans?
Well, I think we've already demonstrated through the actions we've already taken that we've had quite a significant impact. But this is always going to be something that requires responses from other levels of government. And I think by taking the action we can take, we've done the things that we can do, and we will continue to do those. On the pipelines, for example, there is also a strong endorsement of the competition reforms we've put in place for gas pipelines. That was endorsed by the ACCC, and they believe that that will continue to have a positive impact not only next year but the years that follow. And they've encouraged us to keep on going with those reforms, which were secured, I should stress, also through a COAG process, getting the states and territories on board as well by Josh Frydenberg.
Now, the Prime Minister says the government will focus on putting more money into people's pockets next year. How will you deliver that promise next year?
Well, just staying on electricity for a start. I mean, the other discussion we had this year was with the electricity retailers. Now, we already know that as a result of that direct intervention, some 100,000 households have already moved off standard offers, and they've had discounts of around about 20% and more. So on electricity prices, the National Energy Guarantee, which we know would also reduce prices together with other things happening in the market by $400 a year on a standard $1,500 household bill. Next year, we've made it very clear that we'll be working hard on how we can deliver a middle-income tax relief. So over the summer and the lead-up into next year's budget and beyond, what you know that the Prime Minister and I will be working on is how to cut people's taxes, as we already have already on income taxes and company taxes. The Labor Party, they'll be working on how, if they're elected, they can increase them. And I think there's a very clear choice there.
How can you deliver on that pledge to cut personal income tax and still meet the projected surplus for 2021?
Well, we certainly won't be doing it unless both of those requirements are met, and we're obviously confident that we can meet both of those. And we're the government that has secured and held on to our AAA credit rating, despite this time last year, when it was under a lot of pressure, we once again were able to deliver a mid-year update and then a budget which gave international ratings agencies confidence because we were meeting our targets. Early next week on Monday, we'll be handing down the mid-year statement, and that again, I think, will demonstrate the government is on track, and that continues to give confidence about our economic and fiscal management and, you know, the mess we inherited.
The Coalition is obviously deeply worried about its prospects in Bennelong. If the party's actions are any guide, the Prime Minister's visited, Julie Bishop's visited the seat several times, Paul Fletcher, Kristen Porter, Maurice Payne, Greg Hunt, yourself, Josh Frydenberg, even John Howard's been on repeated visits. That high tempo seems to illustrate that Coalition is very worried about losing it.
It's an important by-election, and you'd expect all of us to turn up, as we would, and I'll be out there on Saturday as well. And there's a simple reason for this. I mean, a vote for Christina Keneally is a vote for Bill Shorten in Bennelong. It takes Bill Shorten a step closer to being able to put in place his high-tax agenda. I mean, they want to put in $164 billion of higher taxes on the Australian economy. Our Australian economy is re-emerging. We're creating 1,000 jobs on average thereabouts this year a day as a result of the where the economy's heading and the strong settings we've put into the economy. We want to see that keep going. We want to see small businesses keep their tax cuts, and the Labor Party will reverse those tax cuts. There's a clear choice in Bennelong, and a vote for Labor is a vote for Bill Shorten.
Well, if Labor wins it, how damaged will Mr Turnbull's leadership be?
Well, I don't believe that will occur because I'm trusting the good
people
of Bennelong. No, I didn't say that at all, Sabra. That you can't put words in my mouth. What I've said is that I think there's a strong case for John Alexander, who's been a great local candidate, a great local member in Bennelong for many years now. He's got a track record out there. There's the $100 million extra that is going into the Macquarie Transport interchange. By contrast, you've got a failed Premier of New South Wales who ran the economy into the ground and is using this by-election as a job advertisement to take Sam Dastyari's job in the Senate. Her heart isn't set on representing the people of Bennelong. It's wherever she can represent the Labor Party, and this can be a good job application from her point of view to get a seat in the Senate. That's pretty clear after, you know, the shocking events of yesterday when Bill Shorten failed another test by not kicking Sam Dastyari out of the Labor Party. Once again, he just did nothing. He just sat on his hands and allowed this chaos to ensue, just like he did on his own side on the citizenship issue.
Treasurer Scott Morrison, thank you for joining the program. We're out of time.
Thanks very much, Sabra.
You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's now 12 minutes past 8. The Australian Federal Police is celebrating 100 years of service this week. Back in 1917, a protester threw an egg at then Prime Minister Billy Hughes, knocking off his hat at an event in Queensland. The PM insisted the local police arrest the demonstrator, but the officer wouldn't, arguing he didn't have the power. Enraged by that, Billy Hughes had laws passed within 2 weeks, setting up the AFP. The current Commissioner, Andrew Colvin, is delivering a speech tonight marking the century. I spoke with him earlier. Commissioner Colvin, thanks for joining AM.
No, Sabra, thank you for having me on.
The AFP is a very different organisation now to the one set up to deal with that protester and the egg. You're dealing with terrorism, child exploitation, detecting and stocking drug imports. What is the biggest challenge that you worry about?
Well, look, I think it goes without saying that the biggest challenge, of course, is terrorism. National security continues to be our number one priority, and protecting the community and making Australians safe is what we do. But who could have imagined in 1917 what we would be dealing with now? Technology has completely revolutionised policing. It's revolutionised crime. Globalisation has meant that, you know, the borders and the sovereignty issues that we took so seriously in 1917 have changed remarkably since then.
How concerned are you by that pace of change and the inability of current policing culture to keep up?
Well, and that's one of the things that does concern me, Sabra. We've spent the last 18 months trying to look forward and not to predict crime, because I think that would set us up to fail, but to try and predict what are the environment, what are the factors in the environment that are going to affect policing. And for 100 years, I think policing has been very good, and probably even longer than 100 years, at evolving as the environment has changed around us. But the last 15 or 20 years has shown us, with the pace of technological change, the rapid globalisation of everything that we do, that we can't just evolve because we're constantly playing catch-up. So now's the time for us to look forward and say, what do we need to do and how do we actually revolutionise policing?
So you want a broad conversation about policing, to think about doing the job differently. Exactly what do you mean?
Well, that's right. I mean, let's look at terrorism. I mean, it's a topic that gets a lot of attention. It's a topic that gets a lot of commentary. The key thing for policing in dealing with terrorism is we've changed our posture completely. We focus far more, obviously, on disrupting. We focus far more on those preparatory acts long before there's a terrorism act, so that we can stop crime long before it happens. I think that's a lesson that we can use in all of our criminal our investigations, particularly in a Commonwealth space. When you think about organised crime and transnational crime, we need to change our thinking and make sure that we are actually doing everything we can to stop the impact of organised crime rather than simply trying to detect and prosecute it.
The second century for the AFP will begin with the agency included in the new Home Affairs Department. Do you have any reservations about that?
No. This is a very positive development for, I think, all agencies. It's very good for the AFP because we have a cabinet minister, and I think the AFP over the last 15 and 20 years has shown that we sit at the centre of the national security agenda here in this country and probably internationally as well. So I think it makes sense that we have a cabinet minister, but moreover, I think it aligns all of the agencies who have a direct interest in keeping Australians safe in the one portfolio, and that can only be a good thing.
So what is that benefit of having the minister at the cabinet table and not in the outer ministry?
Well, look, I think it's about influence. It's about making sure that law enforcement and domestic security is given the same level of attention, the same level of effort that our external security is given as well. It's very difficult for me as the police commissioner to draw distinctions these days between what's happening, for instance, in Iraq and Syria and the impacts it has here at home in Australia. So we can no longer just simply divide our efforts between domestic security and international security or our foreign policy efforts. It really is all mixed in together now.
In recent years, there have been terror attacks timed for Christmas. What can you say to Australians about their safety right now, be it in shopping centres, markets or at Christmas carol events?
Look, I think get out and enjoy the wonderful time of the year that it is. The Christmas season, the holiday season has traditionally been a time in Australia where we get out and we enjoy the weather, we get out and enjoy the beaches, we get out and enjoy the sporting events, and that's exactly what we should be doing. Yes, we need to be vigilant. Yes, we should never be complacent. And I know that law enforcement and security agencies around the country are working doubly as hard to make sure that we can get out and enjoy those events. But at the same time, we shouldn't put any extra attention on this part of the year to any other time of the year. We work hard 365 days a year. The threat lasts for 365 days of the year. Right now, we, of course, are making sure that events that attract a lot of individuals, we see the Crowded Places strategy launched earlier this year. They are key strategies and key ideas. The key message, though, to individuals who want to attend these events is get out there and enjoy them. But if you see something that you're not sure about, then call it into police.
Andrew Colvin, thank you for joining AM this morning.
Sabra, thanks for having me on.
The AFP Commissioner, Andrew Colvin. The man charged with yesterday's bombing of a New York subway passenger corridor posted a warning to Donald Trump on Facebook moments before the attack, according to court documents. US President has repeated his call to end two immigration programs that alleged terrorists have used to enter the United States. North America correspondent Stephanie March reports from Washington.
Heavily armed police stand outside the Port Authority bus terminal as New Yorkers go about their business, a day after a bomb exploded in a passenger tunnel below, injuring three commuters. City authorities this morning charged 27-year-old Bangladeshi national Akayed Ullah with multiple terrorism offences over the rush hour attack. US Acting District Attorney June H. Kim says the timing and location was no accident.
He allegedly selected the location and timing to maximise human casualties. As alleged, he also admitted that he had been inspired by ISIS to carry out his attack, saying that he had been radicalized online through ISIS propaganda starting as far back as 2014.
Authorities allege Ullah started researching bomb-making techniques a year ago. They say the explosive device was made with materials found in any hardware store, including a pipe filled with metal screws and Christmas tree lights. Searching Ullah's Brooklyn home, investigators uncovered materials matching those found at the crime scene.
Officers also found a passport there in Ullah's name, with handwriting that included one particularly chilling note. And I quote, "Oh, America, die in your rage," close quote.
Prosecutors allege Ulla admitted his attack was motivated in part because of US policy towards the Middle East. Documents submitted to the court also say as Ulla made his way to the subway to carry out the attack, he posted on Facebook, "Trump, you failed to protect your nation." The president today doubled down on his call for Congress to tighten immigration laws.
There have now been two terrorist attacks in New York City in recent weeks carried out by foreign nationals here on green cards. The first attacker came through the visa lottery and the second through chain migration. We're going to end both of them.
Mr. Trump's national security advisor, General H.R. McMaster, said today the president will announce a new national security strategy on Monday, focusing on protecting the homeland and preserving peace through strength. This is Stephanie March in Washington, reporting for AM.
In the US state of Alabama, a man accused of sexually assaulting minors decades ago is favourite to become the newest member of the US Senate. Nine women have made allegations against Republican Roy Moore, but voters in the deeply conservative state appear to be standing by their man. North America correspondent Zoe Daniel reports from Alabama.
Riding in to vote on his horse called Sassy, Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore was met by a huge press pack.
What will you bring
Judge
to the
Moore,
Senate, sir?
Judge Moore, if you win...
Constitution and God.
His candidacy has been at the centre of the national conversation for weeks after nine women accused him of sexual misconduct. One was just 14 when she says Mr. Moore touched her sexually while he was in his 30s. Moore has repeatedly denied the allegations, and with the support of President Donald Trump, he holds a slim lead in the polls against Democrat Doug Jones.
The nation is watching this. In fact, we have how many international people from overseas, different nations here today. This is a very important race for our country, for our state, and for the future.
Amid growing allegations of sexual misconduct against prominent men in business, entertainment and politics, the Alabama Senate race has become a morality test. However, Alabama remains a deeply conservative state, and in the former judge's hometown of Gallant, voters like Rebecca Jones believe the campaign against him is a witch hunt by the mainstream media.
Why did you vote for Roy?
Because we've lived in this community for years. Never heard anything bad about him. He's a good Christian man. He stands up for Christian values. We're Christians and he's our man.
Well, what do you make of all the allegations and the talk over the last few weeks?
I think somebody's got an awful lot of money to pay them people off.
But some more moderate Republicans have abandoned the judge in recent weeks, including Kim Dowdle, a lifelong Republican who's now voting for Democrat Doug Jones.
It shocked me. I was super, super pro-Moore. And the fact that I couldn't vote for him, it really did tear me up.
She's joined a group of Republicans for Doug Jones, despite pressure from fellow party members.
I think there are a lot of people that are not going to vote for Roy Moore. We'll never vocalize it because they're scared of what will happen to them. I've had people tell me that I'm a disgrace to the party. I've had people tell me that, you know, I should rot in hell.
Polls close at 7 p.m. local time. In Alabama, this is Zoe Daniel reporting for AM.
Women working in the music industry in Australia have begun speaking out about their own experiences of sexual harassment. They've been encouraged to tell their stories following the sexual abuse allegations engulfing Hollywood and producer Harvey Weinstein. More than 360 women have signed an open letter demanding change in the music industry. Those signatories include high-profile artists Tina Arena, Missy Higgins and the Veronicas. Sarah White reports.
When Sydney electronic artist Phoebe Starr first started performing at gigs, she was playing with other bands to learn the ropes. And there's one performance she'll never forget.
I was playing a show at Oxford Art Factory supporting an electronic band full of guys. And when I was playing my set, there was a big crowd there and it was really good atmosphere.
That atmosphere soon turned ugly and uncontrollable.
Eventually, this guy grabbed my arm and pulled me off stage into the crowd. And his friends touched me inappropriately. One of the guys, whispered something very explicit. And then the other guy, the main guy who pulled me into the crowd, licked all up my arm and my face. And I just like stood in the crowd completely shocked. And the security guard like pulled this guy off me. I ran off the stage and I went side of stage and kind of had a bit of a panic attack. I didn't finish the rest of my set. What happened from there is I went backstage and I told the band that I was supporting what happened. The guys were like, oh yeah, that happens to all of our female colleagues. And then they just like turned their backs on me and started drinking.
It's been this kind of reaction to sexist comments and sexual harassment in the music scene that has led women like Phoebe Starr to demand it stop. She's one of more than 360 women speaking out about the bad behaviour that plagues their industry.
I signed the open letter because I felt like it was a really good way of starting a conversation about the cultural aspects of the music industry, which are very damaging to women, which people in power may not actually understand or acknowledge.
High-profile Australian singers Tina Arena, Missy Higgins and the Veronicas all signed the open letter. Jessica Veronica tweeted, "Proud to have my name down together with so many strong and brave musicians and friends." Last month, almost 2,000 women working in the Swedish music business also signed an open letter condemning widespread sexual abuse and harassment. Australian musician Rowan Dix, known as Joyride, stepped out of a gig to speak with AM.
When I first saw the letter, I was really happy that finally more voices are being heard in the industry.
He says now is a crucial time for the industry to take a hard look at itself.
When things like this happen, you know, it's important to remember that it's a time for people like me who are straight, white and, you know, middle class, time to listen rather than to add another voice into the equation. It's time to listen and take things on board.
Australian musician Rowan Dix ending that report by Sarah White. For 57 years, Sir Frank Lowy has reigned over his Westfield shopping centre empire, but no longer. He's announced that the Westfield Corporation will be sold to French property giant Unibail Rodamco for $32 billion. And while Mr. Lowy says he'll still be involved in the new company, his role will be as an investor, not an executive. The ABC's business editor, Ian Verenda, joins us now from our Sydney studio. Ian, good morning.
Morning, Sarah.
How much of this is a reaction to the rise of online shopping at the expense of the mega malls and the traditional bricks and mortar shopping malls?
I think it's pretty much entirely a reaction to that. You know, the Lowy family for years have been extraordinarily good at constructing their empire. They've had various companies, some of which have been development, some of which have been construction. And in each case, some of which have been domestic, some of which have been international. And in each case, if you wanted to make money with the Lowy family, you followed their trail. So a couple of years ago, they actually sold most of the domestic operations, the Westfields that we all know, and concentrated on this international division. Now they're selling out of that. So what does that tell you after being in business of shopping malls since 1960? It tells you that things aren't particularly good.
Yeah, and what's driven this particular sale right now?
Well, I think it's an opportunity. They've managed to the share price for Westfield's been hammered this past year because, you know, in America particularly, and that's where most of their malls are, there's been a huge number of shops that have shut down, not just the small retailers either. You're talking about the Sears, the Macy's, the JCPenney's, the Kmart's. They've all reduced their footprint within shopping malls. That makes it much harder to extract rent, and that makes it very difficult to run that business. So they're selling out to a big French operation, which has a huge number of malls throughout Europe. The French group don't have much in America, so it's quite a good fit for them. But it's an opportunity for the Lowy family to, I think, extract their money and to get out of the business ultimately altogether.
Do you really think that this is an end of an era as far as Frank Lowy is concerned? And have we seen the last of his type?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like probably 30, 40, 50 years ago, we saw quite a few dynasties, family dynasties running major public corporations. You know, the Murdochs, the Fairfaxes, you know, mostly media operations. But the Lowy family was, you know, they've controlled this company with about 8% of the stock, which is highly unusual because normally big institutional investors would not tolerate that because they see it as being run as a family company for the benefit of the family and not for all shareholders. So it's unlikely we're going to see a repeat of this type of structure in the future. It is the end of an era.
And he'll be staying on just as an investor, not an executive.
Not as an executive, but they will both, Frank Lowy and I think one of the sons, Peter Lowy, will have an advisory role on one of the advisory boards. So not a direct role, and that'll give them the opportunity to actually sell down their shares if they need to.
Excellent. Ian Verrender, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Sabra.
Now, briefly now, in the rest of finance, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is closed 0.5% higher at 24,504 points. The Australian dollar is trading around 75.5 US cents. That's AM for today. It's 8:30.